Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turf Sup Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
Welcome, everybody. I'm your host, Rob Starr, along with my acclaimed and esteemed colleague in the house, Mr. Chris Davies.
Welcome, Rob. Thank you very much. I'm just getting in tune with the initial introduction.
We're doubling up tonight, right?
Doubling up tonight.
That's good to know. Things happen when you're not at the studio. And again, just so our people know, across the country, we are broadcasting remote. All at our own locations, not at the studio. So typically when we're all together, we sit and look at each other. We can, you know, so we don't step on each other talking and this and that. But so it's a little different when we're doing this thing for the COVID. So bear with us. We're trying to do the best we can. So anyway, good evening. We have great guests tonight. And also we have our wonderful Miss Chris Austin, who is the purveyor of Maven's Notebook. And she is anything you want to know about water. She's the go-to girl. I got my money bet on her. So, Chris, welcome.
Hi, guys. How you doing this evening?
Good.
We doing good. And just real quick for our listeners, if they do want to call in and talk to Chris and our featured guest, please do so. Phone numbers are 888-909-1050. And if you're local in the Southern California area, 909-792-5222. So, Chris, I know we were just talking before the show, and everybody at your place is doing good and not affected by the COVID, so that's a good thing. But let's get down to some of the things that you have on your Maven's Notebook list. And I guess there was a report that came out for the priorities for California water, and maybe you can tell our listeners a little what that is.
Yes, this is a report that's put out by the Public Policy Institute of California. They are a really well-respected policy think tank, and they have a whole, what they call a water center there, where they have scientists and economists and all sorts of, you know, learned people that sit around and really take a hard look at the problems that we're facing with our water and try to provide solutions for legislators. They issue a number of reports, and they usually, at the head of every new administration, have some type of a priorities document that they put out. So people coming in that aren't familiar with water issues can just pick up this two-pager thing, and they can get some, you know, get a handle, at least a little bit. We all know nothing can, you know, explain California water in two pages. But, you know, it's a handy little report to be able to have in your hand to, you know, keep your talking points, you know, in line. I think one of the neat things about the PPIC reports is that they really try to distill things down into a list of things that are a digestible number. You know, they try and decomplexify some of these things. So what they've done is they've gone and they've taken a look and they've, you know, put up another priorities report for the incoming legislators. And, you know, they basically say there's four priorities that that the legislators should have. Top of the list is, you know, ensuring safe and affordable water for people. And this means not only clean water in the Central Valley, but also, you know, another issue that's coming to the forefront is, you know, water bills that are very high that people have trouble paying in the cities. I mean, it's not affordable water is not just for those out in the Central Valley. I mean, it's also here in town. And not to mention, even in Los Angeles, we have areas that don't have safe water. It still has contaminated water in some pockets of areas. So they say, you know, first and foremost, we really need to get the safe and affordable water situation under control. And the state is implementing a new program that Governor Newsom signed into law when he came in, one of the first bills he signed when he took office. And that's the Safe and Affordable, it's a Safer Act. I can't remember what the E is. But at any rate, so they're starting to implement that program. And they've actually had some success. one of the things that they have been working on is consolidating systems. So where there are small communities with a small water system that can't, they just don't have the technical expertise to clean it up, and they don't have the ability to pay for it, they actually hook these smaller systems up to larger systems. And it's been kind of a forceful sort of way that the State Water Board has done this. But by doing so, then you just solve a lot of problems. And these are a lot of communities that should have been hooked up to these larger water systems a long time ago. And then the other priorities include, you know, trying to figure out how we can help the people in the Central Valley, the agricultural water supplies, because they have to implement this groundwater law, and it's going to be really hard. It's like kind of having to have your budget cut kind of severely for a lot of these farmers. Without water, they can't farm. There are some solutions that can be done, and one of the things that the state's starting to look at is the issue of conveyance or adding more inner ties and hookups between farming systems in the Central Valley so that they might be able to trade water and participate in water markets, because you can only trade water if you can get the water from A to B. And so they're saying that. Also, another big issue would be forest health, and we know with all the wildfires, we really need to be taking action in our forests. And we also need to be figuring out how to make the most of the limited resources that we have to keep our environment, you know, to do the best we can for the environment. Trying to make better decisions about effective environmental projects and such. So it's a good read for anybody that wants to kind of get a handle on, you know, what a path forward might look like. They have a short summary and a much larger report, and they do have a lot of materials at their website on California water. So that's just ppic.org is where you would go for that.
Chris, do you think on the list of priorities that they've documented, is there funding available to cover all of those things?
Well, the Governor Newsom's new program utilized cap and trade funds, which, you know, a lot of people had some doubts about that, because those cap and trade funds are really supposed to be used for, you know, more climate change adaptation projects, not necessarily clean drinking water. But nonetheless, that's the funding source that they identified. And then, you know, we've had the pandemic, and on top of that also, the bottom fell out of the carbon market as well. So the state is committed to moving forward with that program, and they have found money from somewhere to make that happen. So even in the light of the pandemic and the bad, you know, our budget woes, they're really trying to keep going forward with the drinking water thing. In terms of helping out the people in the Central Valley, the state is starting to consider what would be an appropriate role for the state to play in funding these conveyance projects, because we have these very large agricultural canals that have been impacted by land subsidence and can't function at the same capacity that they used to. But those canals have been impacted by groundwater pumping that's caused subsidence underneath them. So they're sort of like kind of a possible responsible parties in a sense, although this groundwater pumping has been going on for decades. And there's a real reluctance for with a certain contingent in the state to pay for fixing these canals, but they feel that the farmers that use them should be the ones that pay for it. But, you know, the farmers that damage them aren't necessarily ones receiving the water. The canal just kind of went through their district, and they were pumping groundwater. So it's going to be a real controversial thing. And somehow I do think, to a certain extent, the water users in the Central Valley are going to have to come forward, but they have not identified any funding for that. And with the pandemic, you know, and the budget woes, we really need to be investing in better forest management, but it's going to be really tough to find the funds for that because, you know, we have these impacted budgets. But, you know, we do need to keep these things in mind, and we do need to figure out how to do what we can do to make to move forward.
On the forest management, you know, we've all heard about the power utilities, you know, that the wires spark off or the transformers spark off and cause the fires. Are there any requirements being developed further than what we have today? And actually people to follow up on those things to make sure that they are clearing the area around the power poles and things of that. So we don't, you know, that should help, you know, minimize to a certain degree. We won't eliminate it, but, you know, I mean, that's a big expense, but that shouldn't be put on the public. That should be on the utility, I would assume.
Yes, and PG&E's been trying to move forward on that. I think I read somewhere that they had sort of fallen behind on how much they said they were going to get done. But, I mean, we are talking, like, probably 10,000-plus miles of electrical lines crisscrossing the state. I'm just guessing on that 10,000, but I would tell you it is substantial, especially coming into Southern California. And, you know, what's interesting is when they strung those power lines through, the trees were, you know, much shorter, and now they've all grown up. And, yeah, so there is the issue of the power lines, but a lot of the fires that got started in this, you know, earlier this year were the result of dry lightning, not, you know, not sparking, you know, electrical
right.
lines in the wind. So, you know, again, that speaks to you need to address those sparking lines definitely, but you also, you know, we need to be thinning out the forest to a certain extent because they're very overgrown. We need to be finding out how to apply these techniques to, you know, kind of get the fires to not be as you know, massive as they are.
Yeah, that's important too. Mr. Davey, you have any questions for Ms. Chris today?
Well, covering some of you know, the stuff that she's talked about, right? I was reading about the America's Conservation Enhancement Act myself. You know, there's a lot of stuff there, Chris. I mean, you got to have an MBA to understand everything that's going on.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. There's a lot of good things in there, I think. You know, it's one thing it does, it reauthorizes some, you know, what they feel are successful programs like the Wetlands Conservation Act and the, you know, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation Act. And so, you know, those, it's always good to reauthorize successful programs. And there's other things involved there, but this is really something that's aimed towards ranchers and, you know, people that are kind of out managing the land, the more open spaces, and there's some provisions in there that there's some going to be a fund for ranchers that have their wildlife, well, they say depredated on. I think it means, you know, wildlife like wolves come in and eat your livestock, and so they'll be trying to fund them to come up with non-lethal ways to protect their livestock, because I'm not really up on all of this stuff that goes on out there, but I do know that there's some pretty gnarly things that happen sometimes when people are trying to protect their livestock. So they're trying to address that through giving them funding to come up with other ideas.
Yeah, I didn't expect a broad view of it because it does say America's Conservation Enhancement Act, not California's, essentially. So, you know, lots of other states, many mentioned in there, Montana, Idaho, Wyoming.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's ranchers all across the country, you know, people out with animals on the land. So, yes, it is, and those are national programs that it reauthorized. But it will still be good, I think, for California, too.
Do you think with, just a guess, you know, if there's a change in the administration, who becomes president, do you see any of that act being rescinded?
I don't think I don't think this one did. I mean, this act had to pass both the House and the Senate,
right?
So
right,
it's a bit
right.
bipartisan, right? So I don't think that, you know, that this law would be a target. I think some of the changes to the Clean Water Act will definitely, you know, try. I think there will be some definite changes there, you know, with Biden in the White House. But, you know, it's all speculation. But, you know, he sort of announced that he's going to go a different direction. So, but well, it all remains to be seen.
Right, right. Well, I was reading another thing, and I read it too fast this morning on one of your articles about, I thought it said deadbeat dads.
Ah.
It was really
I read that too, Rob. That is wild.
Yeah, it was deadbeat dads. And you know, one of the things with that is decisions on the aging dams in California and actually across the country. And how do you see that playing out?
Well, you know, the thing is, a lot of the infrastructure was built around in the mid 1940s, 1950s, post World War, and a lot of infrastructure and dams just have a useful life of 50 to 75 years, and you know, there's a lot of dams. Like there's the one dam out in Ventura County called the Matilija Dam. It's the one, if you've seen the pictures, that someone painted the big scissors up the side. And if you have kids in Southern California, they, you know, of driving age, they've likely driven out to this dam. There's a big old rope swing. Even my kids have done it. I'm like, don't tell me. Don't tell me he went there. But anyways, that dam is silted up. It's slated for removal, but it's very expensive to remove. But what's interesting is that, you know, when they built that dam in the 1930s, you know, they were kind of learning about cement. And there was some silica in the cement that made it so that it would not, like, harden ever. And so they found a way to, you know, as the engineers will say, manage it in place. But, you know, there are problems like that exist because we didn't learn to put in dams and put them in correctly right away. I mean, look what happened to Mulholland up in the San Francisco Canyon. So, you know, there's a lot of dams constructed a while, you know, long time ago that are probably in pretty bad condition. And you would rather plan to take out a dam than to have it fail on you. Now, you know, the article that you referenced points out that the large dams like Oroville, like Fryant, like Shasta are all well maintained. But there are, you know, over 1,500 other dams in California, and many of them are small, and a lot of them in some cases are just abandoned. Maybe there was a property and they dammed up a stream and to put water onto their fields, and then they abandoned their property and they just leave the dam there. And, you know, who knows? So the problem with taking care of these dams is sometimes finding, you know, the people who would be appropriate to pay for its removal. In some cases, they're not around. But, you know, we do need to be taking a look at these dams that we have, especially the old ones and the ones that are unsafe, and figure out what we're going to do with them.
Yeah, I read also the report talks about how Oroville is, you know, all the things that we've had problems with the last couple of years, Shasta and things like that, how they built everything back. They thought the construction was done well.
Right.
And obviously it's just the the ongoing evaluation or the routine evaluation of these working dams and making sure that we, just like bridges, you know, we don't want to see a bridge collapse, you know, a major bridge collapse in the country and because somebody didn't inspect it or didn't take a core sample every X amount of years or whatever, or a stress analysis of it. Because that's, you know, those are things that when people don't do what they're supposed to do, bad things happen, unfortunately. And, well, you know, fixing the dams or fixing a bridge is not a, you know, it's not a couple thousand dollar job here.
Yeah, and, you know, the spillways can be a problem in a lot of the cases, too. You know, not necessarily the dam, but the actual spillway. And there, you know, there have been a lot of, you know, there was a case in the Glen Canyon Dam back, and I think it was in the 70s, where they actually had to use the spillways for the first time, and they almost lost the dam. The water went through it, and it just, there was cavitation, and it started destroying the whole spillway, which it was a tube, sort of, kind of, that was like a tunnel through the side of the earth to go below the dam. And they actually, I believe, even put up wood floodboards on the top of the dam to kind of keep as much water in the dam, because they had to stop using the tunnels, the diversion tunnels. There's a whole movie on it. It's in black and white. It's quite something. But, you know, there are some dams in California where these spillways maybe have never been tested. And, yep. You know, with our changing climate and our more intense storms, they may soon be tested, and, you know, it could be a problem. So, you know, it's another piece of infrastructure we really need to be taking a hard look at.
So, Chris, at the end of the first half hour of the show, let me ask you a question, because we had rain here in Southern California last weekend. I know you got some up where you are. Up against the foothills where I live, we got a good half inch, maybe 3/4 of an inch, but maybe it's a good time to kind of look and remind everybody here in California that drought is still developing here in good parts of the West, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're not out of the woods yet. You know, we didn't have a particularly wet year last year. It was somewhat dry, not terribly so, but somewhat. But the models are looking not so good for us, I think, this winter. And so far, these atmospheric river storms that we usually get down here seem to be hitting up in Washington and Oregon. As a matter of fact, they're getting another hit this week, another two storms blowing through up there. They'll just touch the top of Northern California. So, you know, we depend on those storms coming down our way. We need at least 3 or 4 of them a year to really fill up our reservoirs. So hopefully it's not a bad sign. Hopefully it's not an omen that everything's going to track north. But we've had that before, you know. Let's hope that we're not there again.
And we're looking at a La Nina year versus an El Nino year, right, Chris?
Oh, yes.
So, drier. Mm-hmm. Much of the weather just forced to the north by high pressure in the southwest of the United States.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Chris, we're up against our commercial break here. And Ms. Austin, we certainly appreciate you every single week giving us the update on water. And for our listeners, please go to www.paidennotebook.com. Become a subscriber. Become a sponsor. Stuff comes to you every single day on your PC when you open it up. It gives you all the latest news, everything you ever want to know in detail. It's not just a summary. It's a real good document of what's happening around California and around the nation. So we appreciate that. So, Chris, thank you very much. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Good evening, guys.
All right.
Great week, Chris.
All right, we'll be back in just a minute after a break, so stick around.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes. A better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
All right, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone. I'm Rob, and along with Chris Davies, and we're going to bring on our featured guest. We have a gentleman here from Arizona, and his name is Scott Rowan. And Scott is the Director of Asset Management for DMB Community Life, Inc., and they're based in Scottsdale, Arizona. He's responsible for Arizona and California communities managed by them. His background includes 30 years in landscape management profession, with the last 12 years focused specifically within the community management world, following a 2-year stint in real estate development as an associate project manager.
Scott also has spent 10 years in commercial landscape, Rob, as we know, right there in Arizona. Just before he joined a Scottsdale real estate developer as the on-site landscape manager. Scott's currently a certified arborist. He has municipal and tree risk assessment certifications along with that. He's held a certification as a landscape irrigation auditor. Scott, that's something you and I have in common. Also, irrigation central control operator, playground safety inspector, certified pool operator, and certified manager of community association. That sounds like a fun-filled resume, Scott. Welcome to the Water Zone.
Well, thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me here.
All right, no problem. So before we get in to talk about DMB Community Life, which we will, because when Rob told me you were coming on the show and I did a little research, there's a whole lot more to what you do than I thought, right? And there's more to life than news, weather, and sports, as the old saying goes. But, you know, right, most of our guests that come on have a story or a set of events or some occasion or some history that got them into the industry in this line of work in the first place. Do you? What got you? What brought you to this industry, Scott?
Well, I was born and raised in Michigan, in the Flint, Michigan area, which is, if you don't know, it was highly focused on the auto industry. I kind of, at the time, growing up, had intended to be a fourth generation in my family working for Buick. And then in the late 70s, as we know, the auto industry took a big hit and things were changing. And I'd gone up to Arizona for school in electronics out at DeVry University and came back, worked a couple of different jobs, and then I worked for a great company called Auto Hall. And they went out of business as part of kind of the recession in the area. And looking, I saw an ad. A guy was looking for somebody that had some electrical knowledge, et cetera. He was turned out it was a guy I knew in high school that had started a landscape irrigation company, and I believe that was 1988. And in Michigan, it was one of the hottest summers we had had. I mean, I believe we hit 100 degrees a couple of days, and people were just left and right wanting, you know, because it wasn't normal back there to have an automatic irrigation system in. So I went to work for him, and turned out I kind of loved the work, worked a lot, and spent a couple of years. And then my wife and I decided, because my brother and mother had both moved out to Arizona, my brother after graduating from Michigan State, we went out for Thanksgiving and kind of looked at each other and says, you know, I love what I do. I could work year-round out here. And he was all for a warm-weather climate. So we hit the road for Arizona in 1991, and the rest was history from there.
Michigan to Arizona is not an unusual transition, Scott, for sure. I have been to Michigan, great state.
Beautiful.
Whose headquarters were in Charlevoix, so spent some time there. But as you said, probably the UP is your favorite part, yeah, Upper Peninsula?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have. That's where my dad's side of the family is from, and we had hunting land up there. In fact, I was just there a couple of years ago up north of the St. Ignace area and Sault Ste. Marie. And, yeah, I love the UP.
Well, I'm going to turn the next question over to Rob, because I know that there's an association between him and yourself out there in Arizona, and I'll let Rob talk a little bit about DMV community life.
Yeah. So Scott, why don't you tell our listeners, I mean, DMV is not a garage operation. It's a pretty big development organization. Want to give us a little history on them or what you can tell us?
Yeah, so, well, DMV Community Life, we're our own standalone company. A lot of us did start with DMV Associates, which was a developer, and where I had started. I'd worked 10 years in the commercial landscape industry with a large contractor in the valley, and got recruited when they first, it was about 2 years after they had opened one of their first from the ground up communities in Scottsdale, and they decided they wanted to go in-house with landscape management from a quality standpoint. So they specialized in really unique communities and highly beautiful areas. Did some work in Southern California, and then, like I mentioned, their first from the ground up community was in Scottsdale. And then after the kind of the 2008, I'm not sure what anybody calls it, the real estate crash, the recession in 2009, they continued on, but as things kind of started to shake out, they decided they were going to, the three partners decided they were going to kind of reach in their age where they wanted to, you know, let the group they developed, you know, start on their own. So a few different folks split off. So our group, which was, you know, worked internally for them at the time as community management in their communities, split off into our own company, DMV Community Life. So that officially took place January 1st, 2018. So it's been 2 years now, but it's been a great ride, and the culture is still the same. Great people to work for, and what we call the DMV community, the secret sauce for communities. That, you know, there's the aesthetic, there's the physical, but then there's the engagement and the working with the people within the communities to make it a special place to live. That's been a great experience.
Yeah, the communities that they've built and developed are just beautiful, and it attracts people. It's you know, people look all over for a place to pick up house or residence, and they drive up to one of the DMV places, and they go, wow, this is where I want to live, and that makes it nice.
Yep.
So for our listeners, I know they, you know, and a lot of them are landscape people. Some are, you know, homeowners and all kinds of professionals. We have kind of a diverse listening audience. So what are some of the things that you see and hear every day from communities and what they want, and comparing that to what your organization wants to establish and making sure that the contractors follow? What are, I guess, some of the horror stories that you've seen, not necessarily with yours, but I mean in the normal industry? What is the one thing that keeps driving that has to make the place look good and work good and operate good? And I'm sure you've heard complaints, because everybody has complaints sometimes, and you don't have to get specific to any community, but just in general, as the whole industry, what do you see as some of the biggest problems that people, they think, you know, it's just like, basically, I'm going to hire a mow and blow guy, and they're going to come out and do my community, and everything's going to be okay. But what are some of the things that you have to deal with, and that you see other HOAs have to deal with, and developers, those kind of things?
Well, you know, I think one of the biggest things is, you know, as a large community, there's, you know, there's a lot of them in the Phoenix area, and I know California is the same as well, where, you know, they're large master associations and have a lot of common area that needs to be taken care of, and that all has to be handled within the fiscal restraints of what assessments come in, because it's a nonprofit organization, an association. So, and then you have a balance, especially in newer communities, where you have a developer that's looking to, you know, they have a large investment in what they're doing there, and they want to make sure they're competitive with their assessments, and at the same time maintain a beautiful grounds. And I think one of the things we run into a lot, sometimes it's just a matter of communication and making sure everybody understands. But you know, as a homeowner, I know in my house that, you know, I could hire a guy and he'll come out, and, you know, whether it's $50 a month and comes out twice a week or four times a week and make sure, you know, he runs the hedge trimmers over the shrubs, et cetera. It's an easy deal. But when you're dealing with, you know, one of our communities is, you know, 60 acres of turf, and it's all broken up into little areas, and then another 400 acres of landscape that needs to be managed and done within, you know, done with fiscal responsibility within a budget, you kind of, sometimes you're trying to walk that line of, how much are we going to spend here to take it? It's kind of like the analogy I heard once of, you know, you can get a hamburger. I can go spend $3 at a McDonald's, or I can go spend, you know, $15 at a higher end restaurant, maybe even more. You kind of have to find that balance of quality and fiscal responsibility. And everybody's an expert, so. And it's understandable. It's just a matter of having the opportunity to communicate and talk with them, and make sure they know what you're doing is in the best interest for them as well.
I know, you know, as you know, we're a manufacturer of irrigation components and other things. And I know when we see contractors and they're out bidding, they always put their best foot forward. They start off with a bang and everything. And I've seen the average maybe every 3 to 5 years where people make a change, and for some reason it doesn't work out. And there could be lots of reasons for that. Maybe the other company, the landscape company, is having personnel problems. Maybe there's a lack of communication between the landscape company and the developer or the HOA and things like that. And I think, you know, what it was, when you look at things like that, what's important to you? Because like you said, you've got to deal with the budget. You're responsible for that. And the place has to have curb appeal. I mean, if you don't have the curb appeal, no one's going to move there. No one wants to stay there. What's the biggest thing that you have to do with the contractors, or what do you see that you look for?
What I really look for is experience and expertise, knowledge, and the ability to handle a project, whatever the size may be. I mean, we handle everything from, there's a small association in Scottsdale that's literally has a walkway that's, you know, 700 feet long with some native area landscape alongside of it, some lighting, and then some right away along the street. I don't need, you know, I have a lot more options of who I can choose from to handle that landscape, as opposed to, say, a community that, within common areas has 25,000 trees, and like I mentioned, 50 acres of turf, or another one that's 30 acres of trees, 15,000 trees, and new, and trees, everything from brand new being put in to make sure you have the expertise that they're being pruned correctly when young, because the pruning of trees is most important in the early stages, so you're establishing that form correctly. And if you ruin it early, you might as well plan on replacing it later. So, again, I think expertise and experience in whatever level of landscaping management you're looking for is important.
Do you see that having the knowledge, I mean, you clearly yourself, I know you have that knowledge, but for HOAs or community development people, that they should have somebody or people on board who understand technologies. For example, I went to an HOA in California, and they kept saying, gee, you know, we have a contract with this company, and they charge X amount of dollars for changing things like a valve's bad or this and that. And sometimes the valve could be bad, but maybe the valve, there's only a few things that can make a valve go bad. And one that's pretty common is when you see you have dirt, excuse my dogs here, you have dirt on the diaphragm, and the diaphragm doesn't close. So then it starts to leak. But a lot of times some of these contractors come back and say, oh, well, we have to replace the whole valve, and they charge hundreds of dollars to do that, when it could have been a little $3 or $5 diaphragm and you know, 15 minutes worth of work. I mean, so how important is it for the people who are running the management and that to really have a good understanding of what could be wrong and what the problem is? And also the technology that's available, and, you know, how do you guys go out and see what's the new innovation? Sorry, it's a loaded question with the two-part question there, but they all sort of go together.
Yeah, and I think there's some communities that have that. There's some that don't. I know locally within the, you know, here, and locally, actually nationally, the Community Association Institute, CAI, I know they do a lot of, you know, things like lunch and learns, and you know, there's a lot of vendors involved, especially landscape vendors involved with that, that will do training. Because, you know, spending a little time dipping into the community management world, they're really focused on governance and things like that, and counting. They're either counting on a good relationship with who they've chosen, which is a lot of times managers will have those relationships and establish that trust within the industry and count on them to, you know, to be ethical in what they're doing. I think the unique thing of DMB, you know, through the years was they felt it important that they established that on each community, and they'd have somebody like me on other communities, which they've had. So to be out there and kind of working with the contractor and establishing that trust, and not so much, you hope you don't have to go around and keep an eye on them. I think that goes, again, back to selecting a vendor and understanding, working and talking to past customers and making sure that you're getting somebody you can trust and work with. Because I have seen that, especially back in the days working. I worked spent about 3 years down in Southern California and saw some goofy things going on in some of the communities around there. So unfortunately, it's out there, but there's also a lot of good people out there that you rely and trust on.
Yeah, people are certainly important, Scott, for sure. While we have the opportunity to talk about, let me ask you a question, if I can focus a little bit on the irrigation side of all the developments you've got there, Scott. I mean, there are challenges abounding right now in the industry, right? Irrigation side, availability of water, cost of water. Can you tell us about some of your experiences there, improvements perhaps you've made on the conservation side, water savings, maybe better practices, better products, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so the communities I've been involved with, thankfully, have been willing to spend that money up front to go with central control systems. And over the years, I've been happy to see them advance. One of our communities, we started out with an older central control system, and it's been nice to see advancements over the last couple of years as we have transitioned and tried out, you know, various cloud-based irrigation control systems, and it's been wonderful. You know, one of our communities, this year alone in one community is a $2.1 million water budget, because water costs are going up, and I've been working hard to remind people that, especially here in Arizona, you know, all our water comes from somewhere else to irrigate anything we get. And the systems we have set up here that the state has set up and are good, and there may not be a, you know, a worry yet of running out of water, but I'll guarantee you water is going to continue to go up, as I'm sure you guys are aware. So
The more importance we can put into management and conserving and making sure we're doing the right thing. And then, you know, here in Arizona as well, our Arizona Department of Water Resources, they're currently working on their fifth management plan, which is going to even reduce more, you know, water that will be allotted to landscape. We just, in one of our communities, we just finished our landscape inventory, conservation allotment inventory for the ADWR. And so we'll be required to, you know, it's going to give us a baseline of where we need to work. And it's, you need to make sure you have professionals in there. So I know we had a landscape committee come on board and made a recommendation, and we brought on a, I believe he was on your show about a month ago, but brought on a irrigation consultant, and he's working working well with our contractor and doing scheduling and doing audits, and we'll continue to fine-tune the system, as well as our community is reaching an age now. We've got areas of one community that's, you know, it's 15 years old now, and there's some irrigation that's in sorely need of being replaced. So as we start to renovate that and work with a, you know, work with a water management consultant, we'll be ready for the future.
You talked a lot about central control, you know, very important part of large-scale irrigation or landscape management. But are you doing anything with, you know, short of that, with smart water or, smart connected devices, sensor technology, for example, you know, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, all of our communities, every community we have smart controllers. One of our contractors, they have a very stout and very, very proud of their water management division. So one of the controllers uses kind of a weather-based system. I'm not sure if you talk about brands, but it's an ET water controller, and they you know, it calls in on various local weather stations, but they monitor ET. Our flood control district has some great weather stations that they monitor regularly, ET, rainfall, et cetera. So they'll update it as needed, and then set ET-based schedules. So, all our communities are utilizing smart controllers throughout, and we're on the constant lookout for, you know, what advancements are being made in the industry as far as that controller system.
Does any of your communities have their own weather stations? Because I know a lot of companies who get that information from weather stations, it's not necessarily near your locations. There's different microclimates. I just remember years ago, you know, I'm driving home on the freeway. I'm 5 miles from my home, and I call my wife, and I said, I'm going to be late. The freeway's crowded. It's pouring down rain. She said, oh, it's beautiful over here. So does any of your facilities have their own weather stations so it can manage its own microclimate versus they may get it from an airport, which is 10, 20 miles away? I'm just curious.
As a matter of fact, the one you're in, Rob, Barada, we got our own weather station. We originally shared it with the golf course there. We have taken over management of that, so we utilize that. And then as well, that the county here actually ideally just put in a new flood control gauge, rain gauge, on the east side of the property, which is ideal because the interesting part is our community, while it's nice to have the microclimate, you know, have your weather station there for your own microclimate, even within the community that changes. I've been on the far east side of the property and just pouring rain, but by the time I drive kind of to the foothills of our property, it's been dry. So the weather because we're a foothill community, the weather can change, can be different, you know, within 2 miles of where we're at there. So it is nice now to have kind of opportunities on both sides of the community to monitor weather conditions. But we do use a weather station from that's shared with the golf course as well.
Good to know. The items of that make up a irrigation system, I know they get old, they break, they get stepped on, they get dug up by accident and nicked. Is that what you see in most of the properties you've ever worked on, that it's more of the maintenance
of that, because I look at it like that 60-70% of the issues, aside from a controller that needs to be programmed correctly and stuff like that. But do you find that the routine maintenance, you know, if a head is tilted or broken or things, that's the majority of the problems that HOAs see?
Oh, absolutely. It runs the gamut. And we even see more, especially here in the Phoenix area, where growth has just, you know, been exploding here the last couple of years. And working in a large community like a couple of them we're in, where, you know, there's one side of the community that has been in the ground for, you know, for example, in the West Valley, it's been in the ground since late 2003, early 2004, to another one that just started coming out of the ground in 2013. When you have construction, new construction, you know, impacting, you know, areas where you're in, and then aging systems, whether it's kind of poor soil conditions or what have you, and we have, as you're familiar, our communities, we're very tree oriented. So, you know, street trees are common, and I'm thankful for that, because I think that's going to be a big plus for the future in our communities. But as these trees age and we're growing shrubs and we've got roots that, you know, not only affect infrastructure, they affect the irrigation within those same areas. So it's a constant, you know, it's something that needs to be stayed up on, and it's never ending. So.
Well, if you had a crystal ball, we always ask this question lately, but where do you see the future of landscape going?
Especially here in the Phoenix area, what I see is we're going to have to adapt. I know, like I mentioned, I had moved here in 1991 and really kind of, you know, obviously I had to get to know a different climate, a different region, a different plant palette. And as I got to know and manage some of the landscapes through the 90s and, you know, some of the trees and plant material that were common, and maybe it was common, you know, there was a period in the 80s what, you know, every landscape architect would use. And in the 90s, they started to shift a little bit, whether it was new plant introductions, et cetera. And they did fine. Some of those things, plant materials now don't do as well. I talk a lot about the urban heat island effect, but, you know, in Phoenix, you know, it gets hot. In the summer, it gets 115 degrees. That's a given. What's really changed is our low, that temperature, you know, and what used to drop in the desert, you know, down in the 70s and 80s, now sometimes isn't getting below 95 at night. Some plants are really struggling that maybe 20 years ago didn't. So I think we're all going to have to learn to adapt quickly when we see things like that and be prepared, because I think it's only going to continue.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate
and
that.
And irrigation management is a big part of that.
No. You're right. Irrigation management is very much important about that. And that's why I asked the question, because, you know, the future is going to change a lot of things that we got going. So, anyway, Scott, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the show. And I hope our listeners and some of the people who also run communities and things listen to what you had to say and take some of your experience and knowledge. And that's what the show's about. We try to bring different subjects and people on to talk about things about water and everything, innovation and everything else. And I know Chris and I certainly appreciate you coming on.
Hey, Scott, a quick nod. Where can people go to find out more about DMB Community Life?
Right.
Well, it's www.dmbcommunitylife.com. Feel free to look us up.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Scott. We appreciate it, and hope to see you soon.
All right. Thanks, guys. Very much appreciate you.
Thanks a lot. And to our listeners, Chris and I, tonight, we thank you very much. And the most important thing we're going to tell you to do is
our planet move.
Right. Good night, everybody. Talk to you next week. Have a good week and stay safe. Good night.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.
AP News. I'm Tim McGuire. A cybersecurity agency formed by President Trump 2 years